Good afternoon. This meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee will come to order, and the time is 1:31 p.m. We're in Butrovich Room 205 in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Thursday, January 23rd, 2025. Members present are Senator Tobin, Senator Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, I'm sure, is on his way, and myself, Chair Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business.
Sorry, I went to the old room. I thought it was Bill.
No, no worries. Your chair is just straight over here.
How about I sit by Bert?
Let the record reflect that Senator Schauer has joined us at 1:31. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Heather Ramseth, and our LAO moderator, Marnay Provost. Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Transportation. Safe and reliable transportation between our communities is key to Alaska's economy and our quality of life. Our goal for the Transportation Committee is to look at where there are friction points in our transportation networks and where there are actions the legislature can take to help alleviate those challenges. Over the course of the next few weeks, we will hear from state agencies, trade organizations, and the other transportation stakeholders in Alaska. They'll speak about challenges they are facing and impacts these challenges present to their organizations and all Alaskans. Finally, we are asking for industries, stakeholder groups, and agencies to propose solutions that help to solve these challenges. The legislature can pass bills, but if the bills aren't tailored to the actual problems out there in the real world, we are not helping. In fact, we are likely making things worse. On the agenda today, we will hear a department overview from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Commissioner Ryan Anderson and Deputy Commissioner Catherine Keith are here with us. Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, would you please join us at the table? Please state your name and affiliation for the record. And do you guys prefer questions throughout your presentation, or would you be more comfortable maybe waiting per slide, or how would you like to proceed?
Yeah, well, for the record, my name is Ryan Anderson. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Chair Bjorkman and Vice Chair Tobin and the Senate Transportation Committee, I very much appreciate being here today. In terms of questions, Chair, we would defer to your preference and the committee's preference. We can go either way.
Very well. So if folks want to ask questions as they arise, so within reason, that would be most excellent. Please begin your presentation.
Okay, thank you. So for the record, Ryan Anderson. I just really excited to be here today. Obviously, transportation over the past year, it's been a high interest area for Alaska, and I think that's because Alaskans have a right to be very interested in transportation in this state. It's very important to everyone out there and how we get around in this large geographic state. For myself, I've been with the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for over 24 years now. I've been in this role for 3 years as commissioner, and it's just been really an honor to serve in this role. I'll have Deputy Commissioner Keith introduce herself as well.
Thank you. For the record, Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I've been with the department for 3 years now, and as Deputy Commissioner, serving for 2 years.
So for the record, Ryan Anderson. So today, recognizing that the committee has all had a fair amount of exposure to the transportation world, to the Department of Transportation, we wanted to make sure that our overview today wasn't just the standard overview where we go through the numbers of the lane miles of roads and, the number of bridges and those types of things, but to really start acknowledging the key issues that we have in the state, the opportunities that may be out there, because it is some fascinating times right now, and really highlight critical areas where your insights and your support can assist the department. So really appreciated the introductory comments, Chair Bjorkman, as well. Let's see. If I can switch the slide. Well, let me see if there's a remote.
Take a brief at ease. Back on the record at 1:36, Commissioner Anderson.
Okay, thank you. For the record, Commissioner Anderson. So there's no doubt we've had a lot of challenges this past year. Just since the last legislative session, severe weather impacts and natural events have included major erosion on the Glen Highway near the Mat-Su Valley. In August, we had the Mendenhall River flood here in Juneau. We also, right past that, in August, was the Ketchikan landslide. And beyond that, in October, we had an unprecedented West Coast storm where we saw unprecedented water levels in Kotzebue that actually overtopped our runway for the first time in our records from DOT. And so those types of challenges, we've been real focused using our resources. We pull in resources from across the state from the department now. We feel like we're positioned pretty well for that, and we'll go into that in a little bit. But really just to be able to respond to these events that are unanticipated with the resources that we have, pulling in our contracting community and everyone else to do that. That's been a big part, just over the past, let's say, 8 months. We've also had our commercial compliance team has been very much involved with a lot of these activities now, the increase in activities for mineral extraction and resource development. When we talk about, the interior and the ore haul, like the Willow Project, the Dalton Highway is a very high interest right now. But really, that ability to make sure that we're moving trucks safely on the highway has been a big focus. And our teams have been really stepping up to work hard to do that. We've also had our highway safety teams working through a tragic amount of highway and pedestrian deaths this past year. We're not at a record year over the past year, but we'll talk a little more about that. But that's definitely a concern for us, and we're taking actions on that. And then, of course, we have our statewide transportation improvement program, which, we've had some challenges over the past year, as we all know, and that was from last legislative session as well. But again, we have really, really been proud of our teams, the way they've stepped up, the scrutiny in the media and other areas, and just really trying to make sure that we're taking these things, we're learning from them, and then we're moving on and doing our best. So I've been pretty proud, with the determination, the innovation. There's a lot of really positive things that we've been able to do as a result of all of these things going on. And we always have to go back to our enabling statutes, which is really what's on the slide. And the pieces about linking together cities and communities throughout the state, the development of commerce and industry, and really that extraction and development of resources, that we're really working, through all these things, as challenging as they are, but making sure we're addressing them all as we work through the transportation world.
For the record, it's Catherine Keith, Department of Transportation. So this map is beautiful. I think it's one thing we can all identify with as one of the reasons why we're very proud to be in Alaska, from Alaska, working in this state. We are a state that's rich in resources of all variety, whether you consider that renewable energy resources with the tides that we have, the geothermal resources, the biomass that's available for alternative biofuel manufacturing. We also have fisheries. Our fisheries are, of course, some of the largest in the nation with what they produce. And our natural gas reserves under development with carbon sequestration on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet being the largest in the West Coast. So no matter where you look and what part of the state, that there's resources there that can support our economy and support the residents living around the state. And, of course, transportation is vital to connect those resources to communities be that glue along the way. And so the multimodal framework of what DOT works in is, of course, very vast. It's a lot of a large area and many modes with our ports and our bridges, our railroads that we support. It's an exciting state, and as we go through and get to talk about the challenges of the points of friction that the chairman had mentioned, it's certainly appropriate, and I look forward to talking through those one by one.
And for the record, Commissioner Anderson, we're a large organization. I believe we're the largest in the state at this point. Over 3,000, you can see 3,445 permanent full-time and part-time and non-permanent positions, 8 labor unions, 80 plus locations across the state. We've been working through a lot on how do we best describe how our organization is structured and how it works. And this one graphic in front of you, I think, does a pretty good job of it. And what you can see is, you know, for our department, we have strategic assets, and we're breaking these out because they function a little differently than a normal DOT does. And that's, you know, the Alaska International Airport System, which is self-sustaining, the Alaska Marine Highway System, which is just a different kind of organization when it comes to the service it provides, statewide equipment fleet, and then the Division of Facility Services. The other major area that we work in is planning, design, construction, maintenance, and operations. And this is where we're broken into the three regions, Central, Northern, and South Coast. We have a project delivery division, and that's really that group that just behind, that's the backbone of all of our standards and how we get the engineering work done. We have a project management office, and we're really focused on getting better at project management, scope, schedule, budget work. And then, of course, our measurement standards and commercial vehicle compliance, which are the folks with the weigh stations and making sure that, you know, we're doing legal things on the road. But we also have a lot of cross-functional support. And this is something we recognized where we get into our program management and administration division, data modernization and innovation, procurement, communications, legislative support, civil rights office, statewide aviation, safety, emergency security. These groups all support the entire department. So, for example, this past year, you know, we've had some civil rights challenges at the Alaska International Airport System where FAA has said, hey, you guys have some reporting problems. We need to get these resolved. The civil rights office goes ahead and enters into the international airports world, and they work with FAA quite a bit on other areas, and they're able to effectively take care of those problems quickly. We've really felt that having those groups that perform across the different divisions, because typically we're working in an FAA world or a Federal Aviation Administration world or a Federal Highway Administration world, or now Federal Transit Administration world, more and more. So this has been pretty effective. It's a bit more of a matrix structure that we seem to be moving towards and as we go. And then, of course, we have our boards with the Roads and Highways Advisory Board, and we have our Executive Facilities Management Advisory Committee and the Alaska Marine Highways Operations Board and the Aviation Advisory Board.
Commissioner, I have a question. Certainly, this chart really represents a wide variety of responsibilities and employees and things that people count on to provide for bulk services that allow our economy and society in Alaska to function meaningfully. Is your department too large to effectively manage and meet its mission? Should it be divided into smaller units that could be more easily managed?
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman. I mean, that's a question that has been asked in the past. I know for units like the Division of Facility Services, you know, it's always the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. There is a lot of overlap within these different divisions. So, for example, the Facility Services, you know, on the region side, we have an enormous amount of maintenance and operations stations. And so from that perspective, the overlap works fairly well. But we also have the Public Building Fund buildings, which is a different kind of animal. I mean, in terms of how they're funded and then the customers that they serve and the type of customer service. That's something we've talked a lot about from that example specifically. You know, when you're dealing with a building with, let's say, you know, 300 or 400 people working in that building versus a maintenance shop where you have, you know, 5 or 6 operators and folks out there. Yeah, they're definitely two different ways. So it's something that's been discussed, whether we think it's like a good idea or not. I think we're more focused on, hey, this is where we see the benefits and how we can organize and do a better job versus, you know, splitting things off and trying to create. The one thing I would say is when you look at this structure, we're trying to eliminate silos. And one thing we're really trying to do when we talk about things like responding to the Juneau Mendenhall flood event, you know, when South Coast region has an event, Northern and Central, they're ready. to send people, to send equipment, to do all those things. And so we have structured so we can move things around, and people know each other, and they have those interactions. So there is a big benefit from that perspective, I think. But there could be benefits to splitting things out. We haven't looked at that too hard, other than that Division of Facility Services example.
Thank you. Please continue.
Workforce, of course, is key for us right now. And, you know, I did bring some statistics on workforce on the latest vacancy numbers, just to give everyone a sense of where we're at, because it's a tricky thing to track. So when we look at our maintenance and operations folks, because on that's been a focus, you know, our snowplow drivers, our equipment operators, we look at it in the regions. So if you look at the northern region of Alaska, we're at about a 15% vacancy rate. Now, that's overall if you look at the entire 215 full-time positions. We do have camps that exceed 20% vacancy rates. This is like the Dalton Highway and the Tok districts. We have camps that exceed 40%, particularly Cordova, Thompson Pass, and Valdez. And we struggle with electricians across the state. There's no doubt about that. When we look at the Anchorage area and central region, it's actually, you know, they have 145 full-time positions, 6% vacancy rate. That one's been doing okay. We still have some areas like Crown Point, Silvertip, North Kenai stations that have notable vacancies, and so we're working through that. But again, that one, 6%. South Coast region, of the 86 full-time positions, 8% vacancy rate is what we're looking at there. There are notable exceptions as well, places like Hoonah, Kelsen Bay, Iliamna. One thing, we were actually out in Hoonah a few months ago talking about workforce, and some of the things we find out is, you know, they had some people that could enter into these jobs, but the CDL requirements were preventing that. But the job itself, there was a job there that could be had that didn't need the CDL right away, and there were ways with some of our workforce programs now to get a person a CDL. So we're trying to think more out of the box like that. If there are people out there to work, we're working through our own class specifications and whatnot on that.
Very good. Senator Tobin has a question.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's good to see you, Commissioner. I just want to dig a little bit more into that CDL, because I know one of the shifts in the last few years has been movement away from the off-road CDL. And would this have an impact if that particular licensure was brought back to help fill some of those open CDL positions?
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Tobin. The off-road CDL actually is something that we've been looking pretty hard at. We've had a couple pilot programs out in rural communities where they will we can take a DMV out there to get folks an off-road CDL, and they at least get part of that testing and everything done. So then if they go to get their real CDL, it's less time that they have to spend. So we have been pursuing that. So we would fully support the off-road CDL for some of these locations where it fits. I know there's different categories where it has to work, but absolutely.
Senator Stebbin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you could help us, you know, when we talk about vacancy rates, what are some of your compatriots around the country facing in their DOTs and in comparison? Is this kind of norm for the nation? Are we abnormal? And then if there's, you know, some specific area you think that we need to address to help shrink that vacancy rate number?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman. Yeah, a lot of our interactions are through our ASHTO partners throughout the country, and it really does seem like it's depending on the location, it changes whether, you know, how things are going. A lot of it, I think, is based on economic development and competition, you know, for these jobs, depending on what, you know, who's out there, where the jobs are, what the wages are, and things like that. I think that's what we see in Alaska for the most part, too. I know some of these areas, like, for example, Tok, Alaska, there's, you know, they have the ore haul going on. There's some very high-paying trucking jobs out there, and I think that affects the way, you know, we're able to compete in that region for equipment operator positions as well. So it does seem like it's very localized. For some reason, you know, down in the Valdez area has been tough to find equipment operators, and I think it's because we're competing for higher-paying jobs. The Dalton Highway right now is a tough place for us because we're competing, and we've actually had We have a trucking group established for the Dalton Highway of the companies that operate the trucks up there, and you know, and they've been advocating for things like higher wages for our equipment operators on the Dalton, because they think that just because they're working in that realm, it's a tough area to compete. So I think a lot of it's that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Just a few other areas for the vacancies. So Anchorage International Airport, 11% vacancy rate. Fairbanks is at 13%. Division of Facility Services, we're at 19% vacancy. The statewide equipment fleet, that is an area of concern right now. We're at about a 24% vacancy. So those would be our mechanic positions. And in particularly heavy-duty mechanics is a tough one there for us. That one's not just us. I think private sector as well is having a hard time finding those people. So, but you'll see what we're doing on the workforce development slide. We do have federal funds available. We're in our 2024 to 2027 STIP. We have about $19 million programmed. And this is 100% federal money for these purposes. And so we have things like employee technical training, construction industry training, mechanics training, commercial driver's license training, the CDLs, the safety and maritime workforce. So we're trying to cover all of the different modes. And then we're also wanting to make sure on the engineering side and those professional disciplines that support project delivery that we're covering those. And so that's where you see we're trying a new thing with the new University of Alaska Fairbanks, where they're actually building cohorts of students, and they're going to right now, and then during the spring semester, they're going to prepare them. They're working with us on what types of jobs they may have when they have internships in the summer, and they're going to help us prepare them, and then they'll go out and get different experiences at DOT as part of their education. So we're excited about that one, too, recognizing that, you know, we got to care for that part as well.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the granular level vacancy data. Is there an overall rate of all vacancies across DOT and public facilities?
Yeah, through the chair, Vice Chair Tobin, we'll get you that. I would have had that today. I don't have that. I believe it's around 15%, but let us get you the number on that.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, it's a little bit lower on the level, but are you aware of the VIPER program? Have you heard of that?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, if you could.
So, I was just asking you, because it is workforce development. You know, we have the, you know, a lot of military bases here, highest per capita military veterans. There's over 50,000 a year that get out. And it's a specific program that is going nationwide, and it's a lot of it centered in Anchorage and some in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And the intent is to train them in the trades and then get them into the workforce. And so we have a lot of those, like said, that stay here in Alaska because they fall in love with it. I will talk to you offline and try to put you in touch with the program director, because I was part of helping kind of get this ginned up a few years ago. But it's a great way to get workforce development folks here that already have experience. I just wasn't sure, but it would probably be very helpful for the state to get involved in that.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Schauer. Yeah, I appreciate that. We are participants in the Army PAYS program. That was one that the Army reached out to, but the VIPER program would be definitely of interest. Yeah, thank you.
Please continue.
All right, for the record, Catherine Keith. On the slide, we're going to talk a little bit about our highways and our bridge program across the state, and primarily focus on some of these key issues, which each bullet that we have here could be an independent presentation. There's just a lot of depth and material that goes along with each one of them. But with the 11,900 lane miles that we have across the state and our 851 DOT bridges, there are some common elements that we've been working to address over the past few years. One of these is modernization. So that includes access to data, digital data, the ability to get information in real time across our system just because of how geographically distributed a lot of these assets are. So with modernization, some of that you can recognize in our online permitting systems. Commissioner Anderson had mentioned MSCVC measurement standards, commercial vehicle compliance. And this last year, September 2024, we did roll out an online permitting system. So moving away from the email back and forth with PDFs and filing, it's now all online, and we're able to then track time to issue permits and make much faster progress on the turnaround of those permitting systems. One of the challenges that has been a common topic of conversation with these committees would be winter maintenance. And so both within our urban areas and, you know, along the Dalton as well, we've on modernization focused a lot on improving our 511 system. Some of the features that you'll see just roll out this last week include live plow tracking, which we're very excited about. So right now our operators, we have 30 of these cell phones in play and they keep the cell phone on when they're out working. And when they're done for the day, they shut it off. But those plow tracks you can see on 511, which is our navigation system that we update on a very regular basis throughout the day on conditions throughout the state. So I encourage everyone to check that out. You can see this track of trails that this plow leaves behind it, so you can see what time it was at what location. And that's going to help significantly both on the time of our staff for having to report out where they were and when they were there, but then the public can just go directly and get this information themselves. And between that and being able to look moving forward at our winter operations dashboard, at that location we have a map so public can see where we're going next, essentially, although it's not as dynamic as 511 right now, but it'll show the priority of roads and when we intend sequentially to target different areas across Anchorage and Fairbanks is what's listed there. So in addition to that, what's new this year is also our sidewalk sidewalk maintenance, I guess you call it winter clearing. And this is for the Anchorage area right now. It's a beta system, but you can see what the priorities are for clearing, you know, both, whether it's one sidewalk per street, both sides, and who's responsible for maintaining the sidewalks. And it makes it a lot more clear what the expectation is for having sidewalks cleared after an event. So again, we're very excited about those. And as we move forward, we continually find ways to integrate them so they're not so many standalone systems, but that there's one place for the public to go to. And we'll see that as we move forward into capital project development. We've before had what we've called APEX, which is where all of our construction projects are located online. That's where the public can go and see the construction impacts which may exist. In addition to that, we have our STIP projects, and these are overlaid. And this was new last year where we had our upcoming four-year project forecast now combined with not only our construction impacts with APEX, but also 511. So it's one place to go again for all of the information. But this year, what we're now adding is the project level planned projects. So there's a lot of questions about our pavement and bridge preservation program and our highway safety improvement program. So now those will be all integrated with the capital projects and our construction impacts, all of it. So it's layered, and our goal here is with transparency, because the more people can look and see about what is going on, what information is available, it helps them be able to provide feedback to us. So we'll talk in length about our STIP, but the next amendment that we have an improved comment system for the public, which, you know, we're continually looking for something that works and that's simple. And I think with this upcoming iteration, the public will be happy with what we have. So while those are all, you know, digital tools, it's all fine and dandy, you know, how does that make a difference would be the question on the ground with our actual projects. But what that does is be able to help us plan better, because we have with this digital information, we can combine that with our asset management system and look at pavement condition and bridge condition, make sure that we're investing in the right places. And if we're not, then we're able to adjust that. And it's far easier to see when you have it in front of you in a dashboard versus looking through, you know, stacks of paper and Excel spreadsheets. So we're excited about that and expect that in the next year, you know, those tools will be more and more readily available along with that feedback on asset condition and that back and forth between them. As the committee likely knows, I can go on for a while about this. So I'll switch topics if that's all right and talk a little bit about safety. safety is and remains a very high focus. And safety, you can consider that security, cybersecurity that may be impacting infrastructure. It can include our worksite safety, employee safety, which is something that we work on regularly with ACOSH. And then, of course, traffic safety, public safety with pedestrians, any active transportation users. So with our safety team, there has been a modernization that's gone into play with that as well. One of the tools has been our alert system for buses, so that when there is a bus slowing down ahead of you, anyone using the navigation system like Waze, you know, they get alerted that there is a bus slowing down in front of them, just to help increase awareness overall. But some things we just, you know, no amount of digitization will help, and that's working on our pedestrian fatalities, like what happened in Anchorage in September when there was such a concentration in a short amount of time. So what our staff have been working on throughout the past few months are partnering within the Anchorage area. That would be the partners in Vision Zero, Anchorage Vision Zero team, and they've been meeting regularly looking at some ways that we can address this, working with AMATS on what some solutions can be. We do have a partners in safety program that we'd like to communicate more about. There is a feature there where the public can go in and report a safety concern. And it is pretty heavily used. So if someone's at an intersection and they see there's a sign down, something's amiss, they can just log it into the system. And that way we're made aware of it. And then we can add that into our corrective actions and go take care of it. So I think together having more information will help us to be informed and make good decisions about the correct fixes to some very difficult to fix problems. On the EMS side, being able to get help when there is a crash, get help quickly is an important part for improving outcomes. So with our safety funds, we've been able to fund Jaws of Life kits to EMS providers across the state and also expand access to these medevac sites that are along these rural high-speed routes. So that way we can, if there is medevac that has to happen, they can get there quicker and get somebody directly to the hospital. Other things on this list that are worth, all of these are worth talking about. Of course, project cost escalation is something that'll be a theme throughout, I think, this entire presentation, where we're struggling to address all of the identified needs throughout the state with the available funds that we have. And so through some of our project delivery work, we're just trying to be as careful as we can with our cost estimates and continually going back to refine costs so that we can account for any increased costs that may occur for things that may be unpredictable or just increase materials costs. Perhaps at this point I'll take Commissioner in anything else to touch on this.
For the record, Ryan Anderson. Yeah, so I guess, you know, if you look at the list, so we've had some challenges here on the highway side. When you look at bridge conditions, for example, we're focused on bridges. I know we had the Rabbit Creek overcrossing, you know, that one, which was very unfortunate. Our bridge crews are being very diligent reviewing, you know, doing that root cause analysis on that and making sure that we're addressing any other similar type bridges in the state. To be honest, those are some 1970s era bridges, and the way they were designed is different than a lot of the other overcrossings. So making sure we're covering ourselves on that. There's this planning authority on national highway system routes, you know, and this goes back to our discussions with the MPOs and you know, who's on first when it comes to our national highway system. So that'll continue to be a topic, and we're doing diligent work on that to make sure we do it right. The deferred maintenance, of course, I think is something that we've heard and is a good topic to discuss. The right-of-way management has been a key thing for us over the past year, just for the fact that the abandoned vehicle program has been very successful. We now are looking at abandoned buildings on airports, and then we have the homeless encampments as well that we're, you know, working to address the best way we can. So I think with those, and then of course the last bullet is the de-icing chemicals on the highways and making sure we're, you know, listening and doing the best job we can to make sure we, you know, are prudent with that as well. So yeah, that's kind of the running list.
Mm-hmm. For the record, Catherine Keith. So the next we get to our rural airport system. Across the state, we have 235 state-owned and operated airports. We have over 300 air carriers that serve these airports. And a couple things to consider with our airport funding. For capital funding, we largely have our airport improvement program, which comes from the Federal Aviation Administration. And then in addition to that, there's additional funding through the bipartisan infrastructure law that comes in the form of our airport infrastructure grants and then some terminal grants that we didn't have in previous years. Last year in FY24, we executed 70 grants for our airport system. In FY25, we expect that to be 73. There will be a slight increase of funds coming into the state in FY23. We're expecting about $190 million in AIP funds with another $40 million from that bipartisan infrastructure funding. So overall trends, when we in FY21 and 2021, we had about six projects that went out on the tentative advertising list. In last year, we had 16 of them that went out for construction. This year in 25, we're expecting eight. And so these numbers are cyclical with our airports because there's multi-year jobs. And so with last year, we had 16 go out. So this year, they might not seem as many on that tentative advertising list, but they are carryover from this last year. Several challenges with our rural aviation program. Our airport lighting systems are continually impacting our communities and their ability to get emergency services when they're needed. The airport lighting systems will go out, and it may be several days before they can get someone out there to fix it. We've been working to provide these emergency lighting kits, at least to rural hubs, so that we're able to quickly dispatch them to airports when lighting goes out. Those are still in process of making sure we have them distributed. But we want to correct the problem, not just have the band-aids of these emergency lighting projects. So we have eight right now that are opened up across the state, and these will be eight lighting improvement projects, Hooslea, Koyuk, Rampart, Kivalina, Teller, Wales. So we're hoping through this shift that we can replace the lighting systems, some of which are over 30 years old. They're just technology that's not supported anymore, getting new parts. They all have to be swapped out. Our airport system has a lot of needs, and so we're balancing out the needs for these lighting systems with other ones across the state. Another challenge with our airports is our AWAS stations, our weather reporting, our AWAS and ASOS. And the AWAS stations, which for the record, automated weather observation systems, and ASOS is automated surface observation systems. Those have been, while they're not within the Department of Transportation's purview. They're with Federal Aviation Administration and the National Weather Service, but they impact our communities and our operators. So we do what we can to work with them on solutions. On average, a third of them are out and not reporting weather. So we have across the state 153 AWAS and ASOS stations. What we see on average is that there'll be 50 to 60 of them out. Mostly these AWAS stations because they're older. So this is a known problem. Nationally, they're trying to find ways to resolve this, but it is just something to be aware of that's constant and which does impact our ability to frequently serve our hubs, especially when the food security conversation comes up. This is impactful. Employee housing, it seems not a surprise that, you know, when we have our maintenance crews that need to get out to the airports, that it's hard to find housing for them. Some of our locations, like at Kotzebue, right now we're running a two-on and two-off schedule because we don't have housing. So some of these items you will see in our capital budget request for FY26, so that we can maybe help with some longer-term solutions and keep employees housed in different areas. civil rights this year within the Federal Aviation Administration program was impactful with increased amount of data required for these ACDBE or airport concessions disadvantaged business enterprises requirements, which had changed this year. So it expanded instead of having one broad airport plan for the state. Each individual airport needed to have them. Anyone that had concessions at these airports required a lot of data and back and forth. And so moving forward, in order to manage these requirements, we are doing some position management to ensure that we can have a position there that's dedicated to this. There was a time because we were not able to get through all of the data requirements satisfactorily that it put our AIP program on pause so that we couldn't go to grant on projects. So this is a key issue for us that we're continually working on so we don't have any gaps in our airport improvement program. PFAS is also another ongoing key issue. There's a lot of these, so we'll be able to have lots to talk about. But with PFAS, last year there was funding appropriated so that we could resolve and work on transitioning our equipment out and cleaning out the equipment that was previously contaminated. So right now we have an RFP that's out on the street. To help with this transition, Commissioner Anderson will talk about that more. We'll be starting with the international airports, and then after that, we'll be moving out to the Part 139 airports after we've been able to demonstrate and have success with the methods that we'll use there. So with that, Commissioner, anything else?
No, I think the only other, for the record, Commissioner Anderson, the only other thing, the Federal Aviation Administration reauthorization bill from last year, there's a lot of really good things for Alaska in there. Our congressional delegation did a great job. And so those are some more things you may hear about, things like the ability to share equipment, FAA-funded equipment with the rural communities, and just some new, the runway lengths issue is getting resolved in terms of our inability to lengthen runways. So we're going to be trying to push on that. They have kind of an extended schedule, the FAA does, to put this and implement it, but we're going to push to get those things implemented as quick as we can.
For the record, Catherine Keith. Well, waterways itself, we consider this navigable waterways across the state. That'll include ports and harbors. It includes our ice roads, which is a big role for rural Alaska and freight and movement of people. With our ports and harbors, there's 765 of them, but only 16 of the harbors are owned by DOT. And, of course, there's terminals, of which we'll talk about in a minute, related to the Alaska Marine Highway System. One of the things that happened a couple years ago to help with overall facilitation along the waterways is the development of M11. That's our Arctic Gateway Marine Route, and this is through the Maritime Administration. They have these designated American Marine Highway routes, and when you have a designated Marine Highway route, not to be confused with our Alaska Marine Highway System, AMHS, this is a nationwide system of routes. It makes any port, any community along the way eligible for funding through MARAD. And this is funding that is of great value to Alaska. It can be provided to private shipyard owners, to communities. It's just to help with the movement of freight, especially throughout Alaska. So we work regularly with communities seeking to better leverage these funds and try to communicate that now really any community on a navigable waterway all throughout the coast is eligible for this. So we'll continue with the education on that and do what we can to provide that opportunity and to those communities. One of the challenges right now is with our ICE Roads program. We have our Safe ICE Roads for Alaska. Ice roads, winter trail marking, that's been something that the department has supported for many years. And right now, It is federally eligible through the Federal Highways Administration's guidance that was new with the bipartisan infrastructure law. We are allowed to spend our federal funds on ice roads. Previous couple years, we've used a lot of state funding to help keep this program going while we work out agreements in order to federalize this program. We're eager to federalize it so that we can make it consistent in upcoming years. So we had a solicitation several months back, both for on snow machine, trail grooming, and our ice roads program. And we're still working through our format for subrecipient agreements with federal highways in order to get these in place. So we don't yet have agreements in place with communities. We're hoping within the next week we'll have at least a couple of them. But this is a big need. There's key communities like the Bethel area that uses this funding to move all along the corridor. And there's frustrations for sure that we're not yet able to get them funding and pass through funding that they need. So ongoing topic, probably more to come on that. But then again, going back to this multimodal connection and how critical it is for resiliency in the ports, it's just something that we'll keep on our radar as we move forward, how we can use our formula funds for barge landings and ports infrastructure, which is allowable.
Senator Schauer.
Very quick question. We had funded money a few years ago for the deep water port up in the Northwest. National security, economic development. It seems like that's kind of, you know, gone away. How does that impact this? And I'm talking your more broad, you know, reaching around the corner, if you will, for the infrastructure. Is that a big impact? Is it still something you're looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer. Yeah, you know, right now for Alaska and how we view our ports, I think it's really important that we're taking the bigger picture look. And what role is DOT in this is important. We've been talking more and more about governance of a system and what that would look like. And I think we're going to be, I mean, it's a great topic to think through, especially, you know, you hear more and more, I mean, the Northwest Passage and what happens. And we know, you know, there's major projects going on right now up in Utqiagvik with the hardening of the shore. Kotzebue has a major road project for a deeper water, a port, and then, of course, the Nome port. And so how do you bring these together with even the Port of Alaska and how they're interconnected? So it's an important topic, I think. We're still kind of wrestling around with it. But one thing that, you know, with this M11 route, it opens up doors to this MARAD funding, which is our most successful grant program that we've had in Alaska in terms of our success rate. So there's a lot of opportunities there, I think.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. I'm going to move through these pretty quick. Alaska Marine Highway System, one of our strategic assets. You can kind of see the stats. Some of the key issues right now, of course, workforce. We're still working through that. We have the ships running. I think Director Tornga has done a good job on the reliability side for the vessels that we have. Of course, right now, you know, we have the Kennecott down with the major overhaul, the major emissions project, and we're going to keep juggling ships here for a bit to keep us going. But we're keeping the service running. As we go through with some of these new builds with the Rural Ferry Program and the Federal Transit Administration funds, for ships like the Tuscany Replacement Vessel or the Taslina, for example, for the crew quarters, we're starting to run into some things where we're getting close on things like Buy America plans and ready to do these big solicitations. And then, you know, we'll start having to talk with having two federal agencies involved because we had spent some Federal Highway Administration money in the past. And who's on first when it comes to, you know, these different federal agencies have different rules for, you know, something like Buy America. So Director Tornga is trying to sort that all out. But, you know, we're hopeful those are going to really start moving quick. I think we have over $400 million right now wrapped up in grants for new vessels or vessel improvement projects. So another one that, you know, we're going to be talking about through the next few months is the Matanuska. You know, that's our 60-year-old ship that's tied up. It's been tied up for a while. It's our hotel vessel right now. And, you know, is it time to retire that one or are we going to try to make something work with that vessel? They have had that vessel up, you know, for the audio sounding and everything, and we're getting the results back. And so really what we want to come to the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board with is, okay, here's how much it's going to cost to have that ship up and running again. And then, you know, where do we want to invest with the Alaska Marine Highway System? We did, when we were down in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, we did meet with the head of the Rural Ferry Program. And there's some really good positive things there in terms of that program and our ability to potentially get another mainline vessel. And so we're working through that. There's some really good positive things there. There's also the long-range transportation, the long-range ferry plan will be coming out here in the next few months, the draft, and of course, that gets submitted to the legislature. And then, amazing capital investment in both vessels and terminals. I think on the terminal side, we're at around $170 million in grants that our teams are working on, all the dock projects and the terminal projects. And we've had some really good success on modernization. We're working on the reservation program, you know, so we can actually have a modern reservation system. And when you get on the ferry, you could actually have a scanned boarding pass kind of thing. We're making progress on that. The Wi-Fi, you know, we had some great folks that just took the bull by the horns for the Columbia. We had the Columbia that was in overhaul, and we just went on the ship and we got the Wi-Fi installed so we could have at least a beta run on it to see how it works with the Starlink out there. And so far, so good on that. And so more of that coming just to keep that going. And then on the safety side too, trooper ride-alongs, this is something we've been doing in the summer, hiring retired troopers to ride on the vessels from the Bellingham route, and we want to continue that as well.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just start with a lighthearted. I notice you've got the mileage on the ferry routes here, but you did, for asphalt, you did lane miles. You ought to multiply this number by five. Ferries are about five lanes wide. A question on the testamina replacement, because, Commissioner, when you and I and some other people visited Unalaska Dutch Harbor in summer 23, we were hoping to get it out to bid that fall. Mm-hmm. How many folks – I understand that the feds do not make this easy, and I appreciate the fiscal efficiency of using Uncle Sam's dollar, but that boat's falling apart. How many folks are dedicated to working full-time or at least half-time on getting the Tusty replacement out to bid?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, no, thanks for that. I did go to the Tustamina 60th birthday party in Kodiak this past summer, so definitely that. But that ship, they're taking very good care of that ship. I don't want anyone to think that for some reason that's not safe or that's, you know. But definitely, so the team right now working on the Tustamina, of course, we have several high very experienced consultants, along with Director Torenga. We have a dedicated DOT engineer that's going to go with that project all the way through construction. And then, there's this amazing amount of folks from FTA, and then FTA has consultants that are also working through this, just because what they've found is that with these Rural Ferry Program funds and the FTA dollars, they aren't necessarily built for ferry projects. And so there's a lot of questions that we've had to go through about certain aspects of how do you treat, the Buy America and Build America requirements, because a lot of the FTA requirements are built around buses and transit. So there's been a lot of work that's had to be going on through that. We've had a very heavy law involvement because we've had to go through on the spec writing and things to make sure that when we put out the contract, FTA is going to be 100% on board with it, because, you know, we don't want to be non-participating on it. So, yeah, it has taken longer than we would like, for sure. I don't feel that it's a resourcing issue. I think we've scaled up with contractors and whatnot. We're in the right places. But that's worthy of a presentation in itself if this committee was desired, you know, to go through our capital program on AMHS.
Chairman, I appreciate that. And certainly if that's not a place the committee is going to have the time this session, it's a conversation I'd like to have. The old joke, of course, is if you can't be part of the solution, there's a lot of money to be made in prolonging the problem, right? So I'd be interested in how we've structured our consultant contracts.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you.
Please continue. No, Senator Stedman has a question.
Just on that point, I think it would be helpful to have the department put forth the schedule for the construction of that ship along the lines of like a Gantt chart, just like you do a construction project. So it's clear as we follow along if we're falling behind. Because it seems like we've appropriated money and been looking at this project for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then on the Matanuska, it'd be nice to find out the holding cost of it at the dock. I've heard that they may be required to sprinkler it, or there might be a request to have it sprinklered for housing. I don't know if that's true or not true, but it would be nice to find out if that where that status is. And if it's never going to come back into service, which is the impression I get, no matter what this process is that we're going through to supposedly put it back in with dead-end hallways and expiration of waivers, that we cut our losses. And I think we need to take a look at that, the committee. I don't think getting rid of the Matanuska is going to be a very popular decision. But if it's never going to come back in service, we got better things to do with our money. And then, you know, we can talk about the capital investment of the whole program, the Marine Highway Program, and the federal monies, how much is going to be going to operations, how much to capital, and then laying out the capital process. And we can do some of those, some of that work, not just to exercise the department, but to take some of the workload off the finance committee so we can send the documents and our work along with it for the capital budget and operating budget discussion. And we'd have more eyes in the legislature on it because there's some folks here that aren't on the finance committee. So I think some of these decisions just need to be made so we can, you know, increase the volume of ridership on the Marine Highway. And also the employee issue. Mm-hmm. How many people are interviewed? How many people are hired? What's the salaries? One of the issues we saw last year, as I recall, when we looked at some of the negotiated labor contracts, it seems like some of the labor groups involved in the Marine Highway are way behind some of the other labor force groups around the state. Now, maybe they were way ahead of them several years ago. I have no idea. But that's something else that we'd be interested in looking at, because we need to have licensed folks on those ships. And if we aren't competitive with other ferry systems, it's going to be very difficult to fill. So I think we could do a lot of the work and get some things preloaded for the discussion. It would also help us in our caucus meetings. There'd be more eyes on some of these documents when we have these discussions.
Okay. Through the chair. And just one more thing on this slide. So just we are in negotiations with all three Marine unions at this time. So that is something that will be going on. So that discussion is timely, for sure.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, do you have people involved in ferry system management at those negotiating tables? We have heard for decades that the Marine Highway system has difficulty in managing the system efficiently because of certain provisions in the contracts. And not specific to any administration, there is a serious problem with the folks who actually run the program not necessarily being at the table when the contracts with employees get negotiated. I'm a great believer in negotiated labor agreements, but you got to have somebody who knows what on earth they're talking about on both sides of the table. Do you have folks at those negotiating tables?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, absolutely. On the committees. Yep.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
There's another note I think that would be, just thinking back of the meetings we've had over the years of the Marine Highway, I think one of the issues that might be nice for the committee to come up to speed with is the master ship agreements and how they're intertwined within the negotiations and our ability, our flexibility as the owner and manager versus the labor organizations, and how that works. I think you'll find that they're our partners virtually, at least unless those mastership agreements have been significantly changed over the last half a decade. And I think they also expire when we change out ships, mm-hmm. some of them, and we can start over.
Please continue.
Okay, for the record, Commissioner Anderson. So next up is the Alaska International Airport System. And this has really been a great story for Alaska over the past 2 years, I would say. Alaska, the cargo, the air cargo industry right now is growing across the world. And we've been able to position ourselves for that growth. Right now we're still ranked fourth in landed cargo weight globally, but we go between fourth and third. We compete with Shanghai. Of course, Hong Kong and Memphis are number one and number two in the world. We've also had record passenger growth. We had 20,000 passengers in a single day in 2024. Five new cargo carriers. I think we saw between a 5% and a 7% cargo growth over the past year at the Anchorage International Airport. So we're focused on making sure that, you know, we can grow more. And that really for us, it's a lot of infrastructure. You'll see a lot of improvements. The taxiways are a focus, making room for more development areas. We've been able to resolve some longstanding legal conflicts on some development areas that have been going on for some time and opening up doors for more apron and cargo hard stand development. And so that's exciting for us. We're also continually, we're doing some restructuring, you'll see, in the budget to have the Anchorage the Alaska International Airport System in a stronger role overseeing both airports, because Fairbanks still has capacity. We would like to leverage that capacity as well as we look at, you know, new carriers with interest in Alaska, which we are hearing from more and more carriers about Alaska as a potential, you know, for fuel. And one of the things that's come out of this too, as we work towards the future and energy changes for us, this idea of sustainable aviation fuel. And this is one where when you look at Anchorage International Airport and the amount of fuel that we're providing to these carriers, we've gone up to 900 million gallons in a year is what we're doing there. And that starts showing, you know, when these air carriers and you start talking to them, they have sustainability goals. And they're acting globally, but they're looking across the world for these opportunities. The governor's asked us to really take a hard look as DOT at this idea of, can we, you know, use Alaska? You know, we have resources like woody biomass. There's the fishing industry and fish waste, things like that, and create a fuel out of it. And these are low carbon fuels that then industry gets credit for. Deputy Commissioner Keith has been taking the lead role in that, and it was a fast grant. Maybe just talk about that real briefly for everybody.
Yeah, for the record, Catherine, Keith, yes, thank you. Both Alaska Airlines and Atlas has come to us within the last year and indicated that they are requesting that we look at this for Ted Stevens as well. They have requirements around globally, like in Europe, they have to have 2% of their fuel be sustainable aviation fuel. So these refineries are all around the world right now, but there's a limited supply in the U.S. There was just over 100 million gallons produced last year. So there is a need, and Alaska is well suited to be able to provide that given our location geographically and with our resources. So we applied to FAA for a grant to evaluate this. It was awarded. This is a lower tier grant just for planning purposes, which would then be followed up with a more substantial one towards construction. And I think that combined with a potential Department of Energy low interest loan option, there's things that we can look at if there continues to be interest. Air carriers have written letters of interest to the department indicating how much they would need from Alaska. That includes UPS and FedEx. So yeah, there'll be a lot of developments as this moves along with sustainable aviation fuel and renewable diesel as well, which is a requirement for international shipping from the International Maritime Organization. So those combined make a compelling argument why this is a good fit for Alaska.
Senator Tobin has a question. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm very interested in this. This last summer, I had the opportunity to visit the NREL facility in Denver, and they mentioned their Alaska outlet working with DOD on sustainable aviation fuel, specifically for our small aircrafts. So I hope you're looping them into some of this planning, because they're already doing work on it, and as that's already funded by our federal partners and working with DOD, it seems like a natural alignment.
Okay. For the record, Commissioner Anderson. So, yeah, that one's exciting. The other thing we're working on at the airports is a solar initiative. That's in the budget as well for a 10-megawatt solar array, and that's just really to diversify energy, you know, and how we're doing it with what's going on in Cook Inlet and whatnot, and to make sure that the airport is, you know, as sustainable as we can. And then the last one there is our PFAS transition. And so this is the budget from last year. The governor and the legislature awarded us funds to make sure we can get the fluorine-free foams into the system. And so we're starting out with the two international airports. We have a contract on the street right now where we're hiring the folks. There's actually a fair amount to cleaning the vehicles and then disposing of, you know, what that liquid is after you clean them and before we even purchase the fluorine-free foams. Turns out purchasing the fluorine-free foams is the easy part. So we're getting through that. But once we get done with the internationals, then we'll take what we learned and go out to the other part 139s throughout the rural areas on that as well.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Yes, back on the sustainable aviation fuel. Like, it might be something over the next 3-4 months to have a presentation on the just sustainable fuel in general. Some of the presentations I've sat and listened to, they've had problems with engine maintenance. Their engines don't have the power, and they burn their engines up. And technology advances and things improve and so on and so forth. But I think it would be good to have that, and more of on a nationwide or North American, to see what they're using for these sustainable fuels, the sources. They're using any type of, you know, ethanol stuff, farm-based stuff, whatever. I think it, you know, maybe cod liver oil or run jet airplanes. I have no idea, but I think we could have some of the scientists come in and have some presentations on it, so we don't be the first one to go down a wild goose chase, because we have limited resources.
Senator Schauer.
Just a couple things. Thank you. One, just a note, I did fly that airplane. That's on here. So
awesome.
good slide. I've flown all the aircraft that FedEx has in that type. Mentioning the numbers of 900 million, I know we used to ship like 800 million gallons a year from the North Pole refinery. So I go back to, we're having to ship a lot of it out and get it back up refined from somewhere else. It's just something I think we should also be thinking about. Why not turn our products here into black gold as opposed to sending it somewhere else and employing them and letting them get money when we could refine our own products? I just think it's something maybe we should be considering, because that got shut down and now we're having to send it out. And then on to that last part for the – I know DOD is certainly interested in it, but it is an issue with some of the fuels. There is a lot of biomass that we can look at. So I think it's viable, but Senator Stedman is correct. There are some problems with that. It's not like we can just turn on that switch, and even then a lot of it is blended. It's a small portion of it. It's not like all you can use, because engine problems and power production is a significant part of it. I like the solar part, but I dig the last part with the new administration. If we're going to do all that cool stuff, we better open up our resource development, better start digging those minerals and drilling that oil, because we're going to need it to produce all those products to do this cool stuff. So get it open. Thank you.
Okay. For the record, Commissioner Anderson. Division of Facility Services is the next one. And just real quick, you know, some of our key issues there. Legacy systems, we're really trying to modernize. And this is, you know, just having those inventories and ability for work orders and things that our staff have good ways that they're tracking work and taking care of things. The customer service piece has been something they've really been working on. And then deferred maintenance on the facility side, we recognize there's a fair amount of work, you know, to keep our buildings in good shape. So we're going through those exercises as well.
Okay. Commissioner, I'd just like to note for the committee, we have about 20 minutes left in time, so a lot of people want to chat about the STIP. So if we could just get a brief overview about the STIP, and we can come back. We had an opening in our calendar. We had invited the Port of Alaska at Anchorage to join us, and they had wanted to meet with us next week, but now they have had second thoughts after seeing our motley crew assembled here. They apparently don't wish to talk to us. So we would invite you back Tuesday of next week, if you're available, to continue this presentation. But we'd like to get into the STIP now.
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman, absolutely. Yeah, we'll definitely work with our legislative liaison to make sure we got all our calendars straight on that one, but would love to come back and finish that up. Okay, do you want to – so we have this slide that kind of gets to the construction piece of it, and I know there's been a lot of discussion over the past few months from contractors about what's the program look like for this summer. We could start here if that's
– That okay. sounds amazing.
Okay. So this is really just a slide. So we've had a lot of discussions, first off, you know, with the Association of General Contractors. You know, they've got concerns, there's no doubt. We're looking at these things, and I think we're all trying to understand, you know, what's happening out there in this section. The way we look at these things, one thing is our construction contract awards. And so we're always trying to make sure that's awards to contractors on the street. You know, to date we've done about $123 million. You know, the estimate, you'll see there's a large range of estimated contract awards. That's because when we get this close to bidding a project, you know, the estimates become confidential. But you know, we're somewhere in that range. I would say of $800 to $900 million, which for us is a high year. Now that assumes that's everything that's planned that you would see on our tentative advertised list is going to make it. And so we're having a lot of discussions with our staff right now about project delivery. And I do believe that, you know, and we'll, Deputy Commissioner Keith will address the STIP and where we're at, but we're at a point with the STIP where things have settled fairly well. You know, we've been working with Federal Highways, not only our local, but nationally, making sure that, you know, our state positions, we get, you know, what we've discussed and what we feel our interpretation of the regs are heard, and then, you know, going through this process. But I feel okay about where we're at with that and how that's moving forward. The next piece then is project delivery, and can we deliver these projects that are currently, you know, funded through the STIP and listed on our tentative advertised list. So you can see the contract awards total over time. It does vary. Last year wasn't as high as, like, 2022 was a high year for us. Some of the things that factors into how we award contracts and the total funds available, I mean, some of it is, a lot of it's driven by project delivery schedules and when these projects can be ready to go, the right-of-way is complete, the utility agreements are there. Some of it is, you know, well, in the past year, I think we spent some money to pay down our AC balances, our advanced construction balances. So, you know, we do carry this balance. So last year, I think right now it's around $400 million of just a balance of authorization, and the expenditures on that right now are around $190 million. And so we do try to keep those expenditures down. And so as that every year, we look at the balance and how it increases, and then we pay it down. And so that would be less money that we put for contracts on the street. But then again, we also AC projects, which puts more contracts on the street. So there's a real a thing that we do there. But some of the things on the project delivery side that I just want to address, you know, utility agreements and this Buy America, Build America. As I think some of you are aware, like on the Kenai Peninsula, for example, there's some hangups there down with one of the local utility companies on some big projects because the utility companies don't feel like they can acquire the materials. They're just not available under Buy America, Build America right now. And so we've been going back and forth. I've personally gone down there to have these discussions with them because these are $50 million projects, $75 million projects that are held up over utility agreements. And so we're working hard on those. We had some things up north, the Bureau of Land Management and obtaining highway easement deeds, you know, for realignments of roads. We have to get some BLM lands. And there's been some, you know, disconnects on the federal requirements and what the state law says and how we can manage our right-of-ways with some of the things that BLM wants to impinge upon us. You know, some of these other things like the late congressional release of funds affect us. I know that was last year. You know, we got the FAA program funds late, and so we did a big, you know, grouping of grant awards late in the year, which then, you know, turned into early this year contract awards. You know, Section 106 compliance is always something that affects us. But really, the one thing we're trying to understand is project cost increases. That has been a big factor for us. I think there's even some national studies now that are coming out about the cost escalation since the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act came out. And, you know, the number of projects and then, you know, how we're awarding those projects and then what does, you know, compared to what we used to do. Some things we've heard from contractors is the local contractors, some of these projects are getting too big. And so we're looking at, okay, how can we split some of these things up so they're not so big, which is tricky because we'll have a project and then, I mean, we've had projects where the costs increase, it doubles on us. And so trying to work through some of those things is a big focus for us. So definitely aware of this, and you'll see there's an August redistribution note there. And this is something that's going to be a challenge for us, but, you know, we're going to work hard on this. We were informed by the Federal Highway Administration that we have a potential for $126 million this year in authority for August redistribution. And so that's a big number for us. That would be a record number for us. And so we're looking through the projects right now and wanting to make sure we're prepared. One thing, you know, the way this August redistribution works is it depends on fund types of where you have funds available. They don't actually give you more money. They give you authority to spend your money. And we have a lot of carryover from previous years. And so where we're finding where we're weak right now is, you know, like within the Anchorage area, the Metropolitan Planning area, there's about $100 million worth of project authorizations there. And those are tough projects for us to deliver just because of all the urban area right-of-way, utilities, those types of things. So those are the kind of things we're going to be looking hard at. But there is a big opportunity this year, and so that'll be a big focus for us for sure.
Senator Keel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, in the recent flurry of orders that come with a new administration in Washington, there was a pause on distribution of infrastructure law money and Inflation Reduction Act money. You know, Alaskans think of this as wintertime, but we know you're getting ready to put bids out and projects on the street to build all spring, summer, and fall. What is the level of concern that we're going to have projects go unbuilt this summer because of this pause?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. So I did have a conversation with our Federal Highways local office on this. I think it was yesterday. And the message for us was keep doing what we're doing. Keep sending the projects forward. Keep doing this thing. The pause on disbursements, we got a later message that that was unpaused. So I think we're just in this realm where there's a lot of back and forth going on. It's not altogether clear yet how things pan out, but we're not changing the way we do business at this time until, you know, we get clear guidance on what happens next. So I don't think there's a clear answer yet on what actually is going to come out of this, but we're not going to slow down on what we're doing at this point for sure.
Very good. Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I have a question for some in the case of transparency, mm-hmm. because I am sure that you do not tweet, but I do follow DOT on Twitter. And I noticed that one of your social media threads touted that in the upcoming construction cycle, you'd be spending between $844 million and $1.23 billion. And I see here that that is a different number than what you have projected here, and also that upwards of the contract, the estimated contract award is much higher than anything that has happened in the previous years. So I'm curious to know what is included in that estimated number, the either $1.23 billion or this $1 billion with some change. What are the large scale projects that are included in that estimation? From folks who've reached out to me, they're wondering if that also includes the West Susitna access. So that's my specific question.
Yeah, through the chair, and I can let Deputy Commissioner Keith speak to the projects that are in the queue. West Susitna access at this time is in that as part of that. I can't remember the exact number for that one. That is part of it. I would say, when we look at the different numbers, and we probably need to be more articulate in our tweets and things. So construction contract awards, you know, those are monies that, like, when a contractor wins the bid, that's how much that goes into the contract. We also have obligations where that includes all the various project costs, the design costs, and those types of things. So a lot of times you might see the construction awards, let's say in, I think what we said in last year, $630 million in contract awards, but we secured $1 billion. because some of those funds will get spent this next year, and that's where you'll see the contract awards. Some of it is with the design and construction, all those other costs too as well. But it's a good point, and I'll take that back to our comms team to make sure that when we tweet those things, we do adequately.
I have a question to follow up on that. Construction contractors around the state are working together and coordinating to figure out how to better communicate with the department and the governor's office about their perception of a very serious problem with the amount of projects available to bid for the coming construction season. Mm-hmm. And they perceive a large to rather large discrepancy in the amount of money that's on the street to bid right now, according to DOT, and the amount of money that they are seeing when they add up all the contracts that they actually have and mm-hmm. are going to go to work on. I would encourage some conversation between the department and AGC about those numbers specifically and figure out if you all can come to an agreement on what the difference in those numbers are. Contractors are very concerned mm-hmm. and they're concerned for their livelihood of their employees, but also the life of their companies being able to move forward because of lack of projects. So it's very likely that in the near future, you'll get additional public communication from them expressing mm-hmm. their frustration and the facts according to their perspective on what they perceive as an upcoming program. There's been many conversations about the amount of shovel-ready projects that are ready to go mm-hmm. That aren't currently under contract. Could you talk about that number? And could you talk about the amount of shovel-ready projects that we have or could have that we could actually then use to use this potential August redistribution money and our other highway funds for. Mm-hmm. So looking for a number of shovel-ready projects, and then will we have enough to actually qualify for August redistribution and to utilize other federal highway dollars?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bjorkman. We'll get back with you on the number of shovel-ready projects so we can provide you a list of what is there right now and then the status of them. I mean, as you can see, we do have challenges with some of these projects that are basically shovel-ready, but we don't have a utility agreement or you know, some of those things. And I think it's important that we can articulate that so people can see where the holdups are on some of these. So that's very important. We absolutely take it very seriously for the contracting world. I mean, they're our partners. We've worked with them for years and years on these in these areas. We are working directly with AGC on an exercise called contractor payments, which is so another view that we take on how we spend money is in a year, how much of these funds, you know, contracts can be awarded, but it might be a 2 year to build the project. And so the contractor payments are spread out over 2 years. So then we look at, okay, contractor payments in a year. And this is something that we had been actively doing with AGC. We noticed two discrepancies. One, South Coast region was pretty good. Northern had a discrepancy, and what we found was that we have these large CMGC projects in Northern. So we've already bid them prior, and then the contractors help us through the design. And they will get awarded this year, but contractors don't get to bid them this year. They don't see them on the tentative advertised list. It turns out in Northern region, that was about $150 million worth of projects that are going to happen. They'll get awarded this spring. So that was one area that we kind of reconciled. We're still working on the Anchorage area and the reconciliation there. So definitely actively working that and taking it very seriously on that front. Shovel-ready projects is where it's at. There's no doubt about that. I have had conversations down in Anchorage about the projects that are currently on the list for June, July. What does it take to get them moved up 2 months, you know, so we can do that as well. So we're working through all these things actively.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good discussion because I think some of the lending institutions have expressed some concern. So I think we need to try to clarify it. But I think going forward, it might be nice if the committee, because this is our first meeting, to take a look at the different regions in the projects. Take a look at South Coast region, you know, the northern, central, and then even take a look at FMAPs, AMAPs, and the new Mat-Su area, so we can get a kind of a good feel across the state where the projects are and where the needs are. My understanding, the road needs is in Mat-Su, and we have other needs in other areas, ferry needs in the coast and things like that, so we're all a little different. But it would, I think it would give the committee a good feel, because if we just look at the aggregate number, not break it down by region, we just go in a circle and we don't know where we're going.
Thank you. As we kind of look at other issues surrounding the STIP and then how we kind of maximize the amount of needful projects that get done, you mentioned earlier that you talked about paying off advanced construct funds, and some members of stakeholders have mentioned that we paid off a significant amount of advanced construct funds that was larger, in their opinion, than what typically has been paid off. Why was that? What was the amount, and what's the typical amount, and what's the difference there?
Yeah, Chair Bjorkman, I'll get you the exact numbers. If I remember correctly, it was around $140 million. But we would also need to compare that with how much we AC'd, which is what we would have also contracted, but, you know, borrowed from the future. So there's always a balance there. And I don't have those numbers handy, but it's definitely a good question, and we should follow up with those numbers. Where every year we're looking at our balances and we're trying to manage. We have what we call the crude unbilled, and it's something we have it on the federal aviation side, we have it on the federal highway side, and it's basically when we, on the aviation side, we spend up front and then we get grants to reimburse us. And so it's state funds that go in up front, and then that builds this a balance up, and then when we get the grant, we get reimbursed for all of it. And so we always set ourselves targets over how we want to keep that fund and those expenditures under. And, you know, for AC, you know, we're trying around $200 million. But, you know, we could get guidance on that target. I mean, if that was something that, you know, the governor and the legislature asked us to do. It's just these are monies from the Treasury, so we want to be responsible, and we want to make sure we're making good decisions there. So that's right now that's where we're at with the AC realm. You will see a fair amount of AC in the statewide transportation improvement program as we go forward here with an amendment 2. But we also have a strategy. We can make those decisions to AC a project or not. With the way our project fiscally constrained, and we're not over-programming on the statewide transportation improvement program anymore, this AC is a tool to help us with the slippage and to make sure we have shovel-ready projects as well. So we're shifting a little bit the way we used to do things based on some of these new practices the Federal Highway Administration is asking from us.
Understood. And to clarify, a concern from stakeholders is there's a sentiment among them that because we didn't have shovel-ready projects ready to go to receive funding, that we put more money into paying off our advanced construction funds. So just for your awareness, that's the feedback I'm getting from stakeholders.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Chair Bjorkman. And the other piece that we've heard a lot about was, you know, things like Cooper Landing Bypass, for example. There's a big project, shovel-ready, but because of the fund type requirement, we only have so much of those funds, so we can't just, you know, obligate or pay off AC or things, because there's this, you know, this world of fund types, which if the committee's interested in that presentation, I know it's pretty fascinating, to be honest, but yeah.
I think they're just specifically to that project. I think many people are interested in the fund types that are in that same group. with the Cooper Landing Bypass Project and what projects are competing against that project for funds. I'm sure people will enjoy a beautiful bridge on the side of the mountain that will serve as a snow machine bridge for a while. But I don't think that's why it's there. So, but I'm just saying, all kidding aside, that's a conversation that would be very valuable. Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Stedman.
Just, I know we're out of time, and just one thing, thinking back earlier in the meeting about the interest the chairman had on having a hearing on the port in Anchorage, which I think is needed. I mean, eventually they're going to want to have a conversation with the Senate Finance Committee, I would think, if they want any money. But maybe if they don't want to come here, maybe we should invite the shippers and have a conversation with them on what would they like to see in a port to maximize the volume across the port and minimize the cost to the consumer. They might be interested, and I think that would be good.
Mr. Chairman?
I agree, Senator Schauer.
Just going to add to that, the Mat-Su Borough would love to come give a presentation on the Port McKenzie.
Chairman.
Senator Keel.
For what it's worth, I'm as intimidated by Senator Tobin as anyone, but she'll be nice.
I told them we promised to all be nice. Well, thank you, everyone. Commissioner, Director Keith, thank you for being here. It's certainly my goal to just have conversations and be a conduit for information for everybody so that we can get good information out as much as possible and then make sure that the policies and the budget priorities that are selected by the legislature allow the Department of Transportation to meet its mission as essentially a constitutionally mandated duty of what our state does to provide for the public base level economic service of transportation of goods and the ability for people to get around and build a worthwhile and meaningful life for themselves that involves commerce and recreation. So thank you for joining us. We hope that you can join us Tuesday. We'll talk about that and make that decision very shortly. If you can't, your ledge liaison is giving me the dolphin back there. That's okay. That's okay. We certainly understand, but we'll have you back here real soon. Okay?
Thank you.
There's no further business to come before the Senate Transportation Committee today. And with that, we are adjourned at 3:02 p.m.